Remember last week when the Powerball jackpot got over $1 billion? There was a social media discussion about how that kind of money could end poverty if distributed to all Americans. It sounded too good to be true, and it was. $1.5 billion divided among all Americans equals less than $5 a person. If we have trouble understanding a billion, we're really out of our comfort zone talking about trillions, and the federal budget is nearly four times that. Our next guest holds workshops on the federal budget around the country, including one planned for Saturday at the Lane Community College Longhouse in Eugene, sponsored by Community Alliance of Lane County and Peace House of Ashland. The person delivering it all is Mike Prokosh, who's an economist and activist on budget matters. Mike, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Delighted to be with you.
You have been at this for a long time, it seems like, and is your focus primarily on military budgeting?
That's a big focus, but inequality and where the money isn't going into the jobs and services we need is a big focus, too.
All right. So you've been studying this for a long time. Does it change much over time?
It's probably getting worse. The military budget continues to grow. It is now over half of all federal discretionary spending. That's the decisions Congress makes every year about where to put money into things like transportation, education. Those programs are getting short shrift, and the military budget continues to grow. So the balance is probably getting worse as the need is getting greater. Poverty is on the rise again. People are losing their homes still due to the foreclosure crisis. There's increasing need for social programs and for jobs so that people can stand on their own feet. And the Pentagon's budget is eating up more and more of that.
So when we talk about discretionary spending, we're talking not Social Security, not Medicare.
That's right.
Yeah.
The trust funds that we pay for directly.
And also not debt service. I mean, how much of that?
Not debt service and a couple of other things like unemployment insurance. Those are all programs for which Congress doesn't decide every year how much money to put in. They're more, on their own course. But over $1 trillion is spent, $1.11 trillion this fiscal year, on discretionary spending, and that goes for housing, it goes for transportation, education, environment, food and agriculture, which is about 1% of that, and the Pentagon budget is about 54%.
54% of all discretionary spending?
Yes, and that's a fairly conservative estimate. That's just taking the Pentagon's official budget of almost $700 billion. If you add the Pentagon's slush fund, which is supposed to be used for current wars but is used for everything that they couldn't cram into the other budget, and you add things like Homeland Security, veterans benefits and care, which are not in the Pentagon budget, interest on past wars, intelligence, and so forth, it tops $1 trillion.
When you say slush fund, I'm sure they have a nicer term for it than that.
Yes, it's called the OCO, the Overseas Contingency Operations Budget, and it's supposed to be for emergencies that couldn't be foreseen in the regular budget, but it's being used as an end run around budget caps these days.
Interesting. So there are lots of figures, including President Obama at the State of the Union talking about we spend more than the next eight countries combined. I've heard different lengths of that list. What's your knowledge of this?
That's pretty accurate. We're several times China's budget. That's the next usual scare country. Someone did a comparison to the so-called Axis of Evil countries some years back, and they were dwarfed. We are far and away the biggest military spender in the world, and if you add our allies in NATO and other countries, it's about two-thirds to three-quarters of world military spending.
When I see differences in those lists, though, are those because people are just grouping the spending differently or not including slush funds or something like that?
Yes. There are all kinds of ways of calculating military spending, but the Pentagon budget is the most conservative and basic one, and that's what about it's $598.5 billion in the current fiscal year, not almost 700, it's almost $600
billion. $598.5 billion, which, here we're getting into numbers that begin to glaze the eyes.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to imagine how much money that is, but you would be spending money at a very rapid rate if you were able to dispose of it, and it would go very far for things like clean energy, transitions from fossil fuels, fixing our broken infrastructure, relieving poverty, creating jobs, even if you took a portion of it, which is what we were proposing to do some time back, just take a quarter of it, and it would transform a lot, a lot of lives, a lot of states, a lot of regions of the country.
A quarter of it for what?
About 8 years ago, Barney Frank, Massachusetts congressman, now ex-congressman, out of the blue called for a 25% reduction in military spending because, as he said, domestic programs will never be adequately funded if we don't trim this spending. And a group of us took that up in Massachusetts and around the country, and this is just after the Wall Street crash, the foreclosure, the housing bubble bursting. So that seemed like a really opportune time to get people to pay attention because there was a huge need for social spending to pull us out of the recession, and states and cities were in the second budget crisis in less than 10 years. So we pulled together a national coalition, essentially, that tried to move this agenda and got pretty, got somewhere. But it's pretty interesting. The force in Washington, it's kind of the radical middle that supports a high Pentagon budget, and you've got people on the left and on the right, some people on the right, who would rather see that money spent somewhere else. On the left, on social programs. On the right, they would like to see taxes cut and government downsized even more than it already is.
Well, I was going to ask you about where the primary inertia comes from in there. I want to remind our listeners, too, we're talking to Mike Prokosh. He's an economist and activist on budget matters. He'll be talking about the federal budget and its parts in a workshop in Eugene coming Saturday the 23rd at the Lane Community College Longhouse. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So the inertia not coming from one end of the spectrum, but a chunk in the middle, you're saying.
That's our view. And in his farewell address to Congress in 1960, a long time ago, President Dwight Eisenhower, who was a, four-star general, five-star general, commander of Allied forces during World War II and before president, warned the country about the growing power of the military-industrial complex. So his speechwriter, he originally intended to say the military-industrial congressional complex, but since he was addressing Congress on the way out, they figured that, don't kick people in the teeth when you're going out the door. But one way of looking at it is the Pentagon budget has grown enormously since World War II ended. Did you know that the Pentagon is a completely accessible building? There's nowhere you can't get in a wheelchair. And the reason for that is that they built up an enormous military bureaucracy to run World War II, but they figured that when it was over, there wouldn't be any need for that, so they were going to turn it into a hospital for military veterans.
Really?
They could not imagine the permanent military establishment we have now. So this is a radical change that occurred after World War II, because of the Cold War, because a lot of corporations didn't want to let go of the military contracts that they were getting, and because they were afraid that the war was a tremendous stimulus to the economy. It pulls us out of the Depression, and economic planners and policymakers were afraid that we'd slip back into it if we didn't have something like that. So, the Cold War had its own roots, but it was also a way to keep the economy humming, and for that matter, to keep, radical movements that emerged during the Depression from gaining purchase if we slipped back into it. So, at this point, the Pentagon spreads its contracts around over all 50 states and practically every congressional district. Oregon actually gets far less military money than some. I think it's 48th in the list of among states in the level of military contracts and military-based spending. But still, there are a lot of contractors, a lot of corporations, a lot of jobs that depend on it, and that creates an automatic lobbying force for continued military spending for any particular contract. So for that reason, a lot of the Pentagon's budget is completely wasteful. We're building weapons that will never be used, a new generation of fighter planes that don't work, that are the most important, you know, most expensive in the history of weapons spending in the world. You know, the Pentagon is trying to cut orders on M60 tanks, but the congressmen who come for the districts where they're produced keep stuffing them back into the budget. So
that's a big one. Yeah, if you can explain to us what happens versus what the Pentagon requests versus what Congress appropriates.
Well, the Pentagon's requests are pretty inflated to begin with, but what happens when it gets to Congress is that a particular congressman looks at the budget and says, "Hey, you know that this weapon or this item that's made in my district isn't in this budget. I want that in." So, tens of billions of dollars, if at least, get added to that budget, and then there's also tremendous support for weapon systems that the Pentagon is asking for. And to give you one example from my home state, Massachusetts. The Pentagon was sourcing jet fighter engines from two different contractors on the excuse that the competition would hold the price down. One of them was GE in Lynn, Massachusetts, and the other was Pratt & Whitney in Connecticut. And after an extremely bitter battle, they cut the engine that was made in Massachusetts, but you know, we were treated to the spectacle of Massachusetts' relatively liberal congressional delegation, and particularly the guy who represented Lynn, who is great on, peace issues otherwise, lobbying for this completely unnecessary, engine that was, generating good jobs in his district. And the same thing with new battleships and destroyers, tanks, kind of the whole range of military spending. And then there's military bases. We don't need anything like the number of military bases that we have around the country, but closing them would be devastating to local economies, to their tax bases, to all the stores that sell to military personnel. So, if we're ever going to get past this, we're going to need what we call a just transition. We're going to need a solution that holds workers and communities harmless when a defense plant cuts jobs or when a military base closes. That's we've got to take care of people and make sure that there are jobs available, making more useful things, jobs at comparable rates, and ways to sustain the tax base in those communities.
Mike Prokosh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He'll be talking about these very subjects, the federal budget and particularly military spending, in a workshop at the Lane Community College of Longhouse, sponsored by Peace House and Calc Lane on Saturday, 9
Actually,
to 4.
I should correct that. The the workshop's been pushed back. I'm sorry to inform you about that, but it's going to be March 12th.
Oh, okay.
Still in Eugene.
All right. I was looking at...
Save that date.
Save the date, March 12th. Okay. Thanks for bringing that up. So anyway, but you can join him right here and now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So when you were talking about holding communities harmless, for example, if a defense plant closes, how would you do that without still cranking out a bunch of money from the federal budget?
Well, it would take some money from somewhere or other. I mean, you could take it out of the Pentagon budget. That would be an appropriate place to look for it. And actually, the Pentagon has an office of economic planning that's intended partly to cushion the blow if plants do close, but partly to sustain the industrial base that the Pentagon says it needs in case a larger war does break out. So, I mean, it's interesting that the Pentagon is actually the one vestige of a planned economy that we have in this country. And that's also true if we look at, quote unquote, the socialized medicine system in the VA. So, the Pentagon is kind of the exception to the rule in a number of ways. It's also the exception to the rule among the right-wing Republicans who want to cut federal spending, but somehow the Pentagon is exempt from those cuts in, for example, Paul Ryan's budget plans.
Really? Okay. So let's talk about the rest of the budget then. I mean, first of all, when you talk about wanting to make cuts to military spending, are there, are we talking about holding the budget essentially neutral in spending, or do you want to see an overall reduction as well?
Personally, I would like to see the money shifted. Federal spending is not at high levels. Corporations aren't paying their share of taxes. That should be corrected. I mean, I would like actually to see tax revenues increase on the wealthy and corporations because they are paying, a tiny share of their incomes and wealth compared to rates within my own lifetime. Times incidentally when the country was a lot more prosperous than it is now. So my preference would be to see a substantial increase in necessary social spending and job spending, because if $1 billion that you spend on the Pentagon is only, if you spent that $1 billion on education, you would get twice as many jobs. If you spent it on transportation, public transit, you would get 1.5 times as many jobs on clean energy and renewable resources, about 1.5 times. So Pentagon spending is a very bad choice if you're looking at creating jobs.
Is there a particular period in American history that stands as a model, a time that you think could be replicated where the tax rates were about where you think they should be?
Nothing is exactly replicable in history, but if you go back to, let's say President Eisenhower, the marginal tax rate on incomes over then, I think about $400,000 a year, was 90%. The Beatles song, Taxman?
Oh, yeah.
It's one for you, 19 for me.
Right.
That's four British millionaires complaining about a 95% marginal tax rate, and that's how high it was actually at one point. It hit that point in the United States, and it was a bipartisan policy. That was a Republican president. Now the marginal tax rate is about 35% on top incomes. Corporations then were paying about 20% of the federal budget then, and under JFK, now they're paying around 10%, 12%. So corporations and wealthy individuals have shifted the tax burden onto us. That's why our taxes seem relatively high. But if you restored them on those wealthy entities, you could easily afford to certainly cut Pentagon spending and spend quite a bit more on programs that we need.
Economist Mike Prokosh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He goes around the country talking about budget matters. As we've established, the session that was to be this Saturday in Eugene has been moved back to March 12th at the Lane Community College Longhouse. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, though, and talk about federal budget priorities here and now. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Is it possible to get rates back up where they were, even if it were possible politically? And that's a tough case to make, I think. How do you keep companies from moving overseas, taking their jobs overseas, from rich people moving their residences offshore, et cetera?
Yes, that's a challenge. We're in a much more globalized world but that's not simply economic. That's also a policy choice. That was made possible by all of these trade treaties, including the one that's currently up, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was also a disaster for, working people generally and a boon to some of the largest corporations in the country. So, yes, you would probably have to make some policy changes on so-called global trade, which is more like global capital flows, if you were going to raise corporate tax rates substantially. But there are also ways to lower the overall corporate tax rate but cut some of the special subsidies that have been written into the tax laws by, corporate tax lawyers, which would make U.S. tax rates quite competitive with elsewhere in the world, but there wouldn't be special favors for some of the biggest corporations in the world who don't really need them. I also want to make the point, we celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday yesterday, and King had a lot of things to say about this as he watched, adventures like Vietnam continue to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. The same thing was happening in 1967 when King gave his famous Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence speech, where that quote's from, that's happening now. The war on poverty was being eviscerated by runaway military spending. And King went on to say, We as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights, are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered.
He said machines and computers, huh?
It's an extraordinarily prophetic speech.
It is in many ways. So how do you, I mean, can you change policy without changing attitudes, or do you work on the attitudes first, or how do you go about changing this?
It's kind of a spiral. the fights over policy, the fights over a presidential election are the places where you have people's attention to change attitudes. So, and then the more you change attitudes, the more you can change the policy. So, you know, as an organizer, which I primarily am more than an economist, you really have to engage people in active campaigns for change. And that's going to be the focus of our workshop on March 12th. We're not just talking about the data or the information. We're going to spend a lot of time the whole afternoon strategizing about what we do with the information and how we can use that to shift the deadlock in Washington.
Is it easier to get people to show up for these workshops in an election year?
I think so.
A particularly presidential election year.
Yeah, yeah. All of this stuff is on the table. Inequality is right at the center of this election.
So, Mike, I guess it'll be our final question. We're getting a little short on time. Can the federal government be balanced in today's political climate, or is that even the wrong question?
I think it's up to us. I mean, there's not only the question of balance between two political parties or ideologies, there's a question of balance between Congress and the American people, because Congress is making budget decisions that are the opposite of what people want. People, polls consistently show that people want to invest in infrastructure, education, the economy, the safety net, and they want to have corporations pay their fair share of taxes, and Congress isn't doing it, so we're going to have to make them do it.
Mike Prokosh is an economist, activist, organizer, and we'll be in Eugene on March 12th, as we discussed here. And Mike, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about the federal budget.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right, take care.